Welcome to the Op-Ed Hour for February 19th, 2026. For the Talking Information Center, this is Dan Cobrin. Let's start out today talking about voter integrity. Trump's new voter ID threat is his gravest attack on democracy yet. By Michael Tomasky from The New Republic. What did Donald Trump mean last Friday when he wrote on Truth Social that there will be voter ID for the midterm elections, whether approved by Congress or not? We didn't have to wonder for long, because exactly 27 minutes later, he explained it with a follow-up post. If we can't get it through Congress, there are legal reasons why this scam is not permitted. I will be presenting them shortly in the form of an executive order. Trump can issue an executive order changing the temperature at which ice becomes water, but that won't make it happen. The Constitution couldn't be clearer. Presidents don't run elections. The states do. Congress can change the rules, and it did in 1967 when it mandated single-member districts. A couple states at the time still elected members on an at-large basis. But the president has nothing to do with any of it. Why is Trump so worked up? The House passed the Save America Act, an ill-disguised attempt to codify voter suppression, last Wednesday. But as he well knows, it's not going to get through the Senate unless Republicans decide to kill the filibuster. Right now, that seems unlikely, and assuming that doesn't happen, Trump and the GOP's main vehicle for suppressing turnout this fall will die. Hence, the executive order threat. The problem for Trump is that no court in the country will honor his executive order. I can't imagine even the Supreme Court will, given how unequivocal the Constitution is on the matter. So the question is, when his executive order is shot down, what will he do? The Trump administration has done many shocking things, far too numerous for me to list. If I had to name three really bad ones, I'd go with the rancidly political investigations of people he perceives as enemies, the staggeringly corrupt personal enrichment, the shipping people off to prisons in foreign countries, sometimes in direct contravention of judicial orders. All these are direct assaults on the core principles of democratic self-governance. Trying to prevent or subvert or nullify an election, I would argue, is on another level. We've had presidents and other political leaders who tried to get their foes thrown in the clink. We've had loads of corrupt Pauls, though never anyone near Trump's operatic scale. And we have, alas, treated a lot of people very badly, from the 400,000-plus African people brought over as slaves to the millions of Native Americans we drove from their lands or herded onto reservations to the patriotic Japanese Americans during World War II. But through all those moral calamities, we've had elections. A federal election has never been postponed or canceled in the history of the United States. If ever one was going to be postponed, it obviously would have been in 1864. But Abraham Lincoln refused to consider delaying it, and he was convinced he was going to lose. On August 23, 1864, he wrote this memo to his cabinet members. This morning, as for some days past, it seems exceedingly probable that this administration will not be reelected. Then it will be my duty to so cooperate with the president-elect as to save the union between the election and the inauguration, as he will have secured his election on such ground that he cannot possibly save it afterwards. He put it in an envelope and asked his cabinet officers to sign the envelope without reading the memo. Note how there was no question in his mind that the election would be held, even though he was sure he was going to lose. That's how a small D Democrat behaves. Can you imagine Donald Trump doing that? Never in a jillion years, and it's precisely that difference that explains why Lincoln is our greatest president and Trump our worst. Otherwise, every federal election in this country's history has been held, and this one probably will be, but consider these two points. First, The mere fact that I even have to write probably is disturbing. Imagine the week before the election, Trump giving a speech in which he says that evidence of Democrat cheating is so overwhelming that he has no choice but to declare martial law and delay the elections until these matters are sorted out. That might not be likely, but you know as well as I do that it is far from impossible. And second, we have to ask, assuming it does take place, under what conditions will it be held? Will we see ICE agents at polling places, as Steve Bannon wants? Other self-appointed armed thugs showing up at polling places in black neighborhoods demanding to see voters' identification cards? Remember, the entire issue is fake. There is no mass voter fraud. The state of Michigan conducted a review of the 2024 voting. About 5.7 million people voted. The number of ballots they found cast by non-citizens, 16. That's 0.00028%. Additionally, Trump said over the weekend and has said repeatedly that the United States is the only country in the world that uses mail-in voting. It's a massive lie. 34 countries and territories use some form of postal voting. 12 allow all voters to vote by mail, including the UK, Germany, Poland, Greece, and Canada. Trump may not get away with this, but whether he gets away with it or not isn't the point. The point is that he'll try, that he feels no compunction about doing so. Also, that his party and his favorite news organizations will back him. We've all seen scenes in our lives from elections around the world where intimidating armed militias stood guard at polling places, violence broke out, and more. We may be about to see them again this November, but this time it won't be in Tanzania or Bangladesh. It will be the United States of America under Donald Trump. Nobody Trusts Elections. That's the Crisis. By Brian C. Jundeff from American Thinker. One of the most corrosive realities in contemporary American electoral politics isn't polarization, misinformation, or even foreign interference. It is something more basic. A majority of Americans no longer trust the integrity of their elections. This is not a fringe belief limited to one party or ideology. According to polling from Rasmussen Reports, ahead of the 2024 presidential election, 62% of likely voters were concerned that cheating will affect the outcome of the 2024 election. This skepticism crosses party lines and has persisted over the years. The pattern is clear. Whichever party loses a presidential election claims the winning party cheated. Democrats insisted George W. Bush stole the 2000 election. Many believe he did so again in 2004. The idea that Donald Trump colluded with Russia to steal the 2016 election became a conviction on the political left, supported for years by media, weaponized intelligence community lies, and congressional investigations. Republicans, especially President Donald Trump, believe the 2020 election was compromised through mail-in ballots, procedural changes enacted without legislatures, ballot harvesting, delayed counting, and statistical anomalies that were never convincingly explained. And now, after 2024, many Democrats again claim that Trump cheated to regain the presidency. This recurring cycle reveals an important point. The issue is no longer who wins, but whether Americans trust the legitimacy of the system itself. It's not about any specific election, but about the electoral process as a whole. Whether Donald Trump probably won in 2020 is a separate debate, one with strong feelings on both sides. But that debate isn't the main point here. The real issue is that half the country sees every election loss as illegitimate, and nothing has been done to rebuild trust in the American election system. Democracy cannot survive on blind faith alone. Trust must be earned through transparency, consistent rules, and procedures that make fraud difficult and detection easy. Yet instead of reforming elections to restore public confidence, political leaders often respond to skepticism by dismissing it as dangerous, disloyal, or a threat to democracy. That is backward. In a healthy republic, distrust in elections should lead to reform, not censorship, gaslighting, or moral condemnation. Election procedures are important. Think about how American elections are now run. Voting can start weeks or even months before Election Day. Ballots are mailed en masse, harvested, cured, and counted long after polls close. In some jurisdictions, results may take days or weeks to be revealed. Congressional races sometimes change multiple times as new batches of ballots are discovered or counted. Contrast this with other developed democracies, where elections happen in a single day and results are known the same night or by the next morning. Or think about something closer to home, when Americans vote for a TV talent show winner. Results are tabulated almost instantly. Yet our republic needs weeks and teams of lawyers. Yet we're told that selecting the leader of the free world must be a lengthy, secretive process that takes weeks of uncertainty. This unnecessarily delays or complicates the already massive transition. It also defies common sense, which is why both parties should support election integrity reforms, including the Save America Act, currently before Congress. It is already passed in the House and has reportedly crossed the 50-vote threshold for passage in the Senate. At its core, the Save America Act affirms a principle that should be uncontroversial. Only U.S. citizens should vote in U.S. elections, and states should take reasonable steps to verify eligibility. Secure elections are not voter suppression. They are the foundation of representative government. Other reforms also merit bipartisan backing. One-day voting with limited hardship exceptions. In-person voting as the standard method. Same-day counting so results are known promptly. Uniform national standards instead of a patchwork of emergency rule changes. A national holiday on Election Day to allow working Americans to vote without barriers. Columbus Day or Juneteenth could be good sacrifices for a national election day. The Save America Act enjoys widespread bipartisan support. Gallup and Pew Research Center found 83% to 84% backing for photo ID requirements, including virtually all Republicans and 67% to 71% of Democrats. Some countries go even further by requiring voting by law, as Australia does. While that might be a stretch for the United States, the core idea is solid. Participation and legitimacy go hand in hand. Delayed counting isn't just inconvenient, it's damaging. The longer results stay unknown, the more suspicion and distrust grow. When election outcomes change days after voting stops, trust erodes even among well-intentioned citizens. Or when one candidate is ahead on election night, vote counting supposedly stops. Then by morning, the other candidate has taken the lead, and this only happens in a few counties of key swing states. Every unexplained pause, ballot dump, or last-minute reversal fuels conspiracy theories, regardless of validity. Transparency and speed are not luxuries. They are essential safeguards for trust and integrity. If elections were settled conclusively on election night, much of the post-election chaos that currently characterizes American politics would simply vanish. Yet Democrats criticize voter ID requirements, often using racist and sexist tropes that suggest people of color are not smart enough to obtain a valid photo ID, or that recently divorced or married women cannot change their names and IDs. Former Vice President Kamala Harris believes rural residents are unable to make copies of their IDs because they don't have Kinko's or Office Max. Funny how these groups have no trouble flying, checking into hotels, or buying a bottle of wine. To believe otherwise is condescension. What about foreign interference? you can't credibly claim for a decade that elections are under attack from abroad and then object when intelligence agencies investigate. Many Democrats are currently upset that the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, in her role, has taken an interest in election integrity and foreign interference. That outrage is confusing because for years, Democrats insisted that Russian interference compromised the legitimacy of the 2016 election. They correctly argued that foreign influence in elections is a national security threat, not just a political issue. If that was true, it still holds now. The DNI exists specifically to evaluate threats to national sovereignty, including election interference. Anyone genuinely worried about foreign meddling should welcome scrutiny from the DNI, not oppose it. The United States is nearing a critical point. When large majorities of voters on both the left and right believe elections are rigged unless their side wins, the social contract starts to break down. Election integrity should not be a partisan talking point. It should be a shared national priority. The solution isn't to silence doubts or demonize skeptics. The answer is to improve the system so that losing an election doesn't feel like losing one's voice or country. Until then, every election will be challenged, not only in courts, but also in people's minds. A republic that no longer earns the trust of its citizens is a republic in name only. Linked to our last topic, voter integrity, let's now look at the filibuster. The Hot Air of the Talking Filibuster by Kimberly A. Strassel from the Wall Street Journal. As Washington grows ever more gridlocked, members grow ever more interested in testing the filibuster. With most Republican senators adamant that they won't abolish the procedure outright, which is for the good, some in the activist base are instead demanding Senate leaders change it by reviving the talking filibuster. Specifically, Florida Representative Anna Paulina Luna, with support from conservative senators like Utah's Mike Lee, want Majority Leader John Thune to ditch cloture, the long-standing process that ends debate and a bill's progress, if there is not 60 votes. Democrats would instead be forced to actively talk to stall a vote on the SAVE Act, a House bill requiring proof of citizenship when registering to vote and photo ID at the polls. Mr. Lee summed it up: return to Senate tradition, require filibustering senators to gasp, actually speak. Using existing Senate rules, pass the Save America Act. His ex post continued, surprise, surprise, nostalgic video of Jimmy Stewart waging his one-man filibuster battle against corrupt Washington. Sounds simple, right? Sounds heroic, yes? It's not. Supporters of a cinematic moment are either unaware of or unwilling to address the false promises and huge problems that come with the talking filibuster, not the least of which, paging Senator Lee, is that Stewart, the hero of that movie, will be the Democrats in this scenario. A talking filibuster will not prove a difficult lift for Democrats. Quite the opposite. It will give Minority Leader Chuck Schumer the whip hand over the Senate's time and topics, and the power to extract enormous GOP concessions as a price of passing any bill. Meanwhile, the only way to avoid that scenario is to further modify the talking filibuster to strip the minority party of any real ability to oppose legislation. Here's how it actually works. Talking by turns. Senate Democrats are pretty much united against the SAVE Act, so it won't be one Jimmy Stewart holding the floor. It'll be 47. Under talking filibuster rules, Democrats get two speeches apiece, each of unlimited length, simply to oppose moving on to the bill. In a total opposition scenario, that's 94 speeches. If each Democrat spoke for, say, 8 hours at a time, twice, that's about 750 hours, 31 days, of talking. Under traditional talking filibuster rules, there is no way to end this torture. Then again and again, Democrats can easily take turns eating, sleeping, and flying home during this marathon. Only one of them needs to be on the floor giving a speech. The GOP, by contrast, will need to maintain almost all its members on the floor at all times. At any moment, Schumer might demand a quorum call, which demand 51 senators. Schumer could also move to adjourn, which would restart the legislative day, providing Democrats a whole new round of 94 speeches. Indeed, any new question or point sparks another round of speeches. What is the left's top priority in 2026? Blocking entirely the GOP agenda. A talking filibuster provides Democrats a pain-free, headline-friendly way of taking the Senate and, by extension, the entire GOP Congress offline for a very long period. Amendments. Let's say the GOP lives through this speakathon and gets the actual bill. Under today's rules, Thune controls amendments. Under a talking filibuster scenario, it's an amendment free-for-all. Thune could preemptively attempt to fill the amendment tree, though that triggers another round of Democratic speeches. Rinse, repeat. The only way to get to the end game on the SAVE Act and the purpose of this exercise would be to let Democrats have their amendments. And outside of a cloture environment, there is no requirement that amendments are germane to the SAVE Act. They also pass with 51 votes. That's dicey in today's GOP Senate, which includes vulnerable Republicans, Maine's Susan Collins, moderates, Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, populists, Missouri's Josh Hawley, and North Carolina's Tom Tillis, who's a bit miffed at Donald Trump these days. Democrats will make this painful and could win some. There are 51 votes to revive. Are there 51 votes to revive Obamacare subsidies? To kill Trump's tariffs? 51 to raise taxes on the wealthy or hike the minimum wage or coddle unions or saddle tech companies with punitive regulatory packages? If Democrats got these wins, they might be willing to swallow the SAVE Act. Are Republicans willing to give that much for a bill that essentially repeats the existing federal prohibition on non-citizens voting in elections? Republicans, in theory, could themselves filibuster individual amendments, potentially forever. But again, that just delays a vote on their own underlying bill. Nuclear options. Are there ways to limit Democrats' ability to inflict all this pain? Yes, without boring everyone to tears with the arcane details of points of order or concur in a message procedures, suffice it to say Republicans could vote to change the rules in numerous ways that restrict the minority's ability to obstruct within a talking filibuster environment. But that would hardly be in the Jimmy Stewart spirit, now would it? More important, any rule change that is ultimately designed to strip the minority of its ability to block legislation is the equivalent of getting rid of the filibuster altogether, which is precisely why Republicans vehemently objected to Schumer proposals several years back to modify filibuster rules. All or nothing. This drills in on the joke of this exercise. Republican supporters of the Talking Filibuster Act, as if simply changing the mechanics of the filibuster, returning to a talking version, will magically allow them to jam through what they want. It won't. Either there are opposition party rights in the Senate, or there aren't. The talking filibuster requires both sides to more actively engage on the floor, and to repeat, it requires far more from the majority than the minority. But it does not strip the minority of its blocking rights. It just creates a massive headache for everyone and seizes up the Senate for long periods of time, which is exactly why the Senate hasn't used it for so long. Honesty in advertising. Talking filibuster supporters are posturing as fighters, those finally willing to slay the zombie filibuster and force Democrats to work for their opposition. That's not how it would work. So they have an obligation to lay out their endgame. Is it to tee up Senate theater, a drama in which Republicans will do all the work, locked nonstop in a chamber, silent, haggard, unnoticed, as the media glorifies one Democratic Jimmy Stewart speech giver after another? Is it to pass the SAVE Act, no matter what Democrats attach as their price? Or is it to get rid of the filibuster altogether, albeit by slippery means, by enacting nuclear options alongside the talking filibuster? Because the only way the GOP uses a talking filibuster to pass a clean SAVE Act is a situation in which it also strips Democrats of opposition party rights. And Democrats will do the exact same to Republicans when they take power. What the Wall Street Journal Gets Wrong About the Talking Filibuster, by Rachel Bavard from The Federalist. Kimberly Strassel recently opined in The Wall Street Journal about the hot air of the talking filibuster strategy currently being considered by Senate Republicans as a way of passing the Save America Act, a bill that would mandate voter ID in federal elections, require proof of citizenship for registering to vote, and make states purge non-citizens from their voting rolls. The Senate provides two ways to break a filibuster. The first is the mechanical way, by invoking cloture, the Senate's term for ending debate, which requires 60 votes. The second, which has existed within the Senate rules since its inception, is by making senators talk, the talking filibuster. The talking filibuster is a strategy that first and foremost imposes a physical and psychological cost of obstruction on filibustering senators. Second, it forces a public political process that has implications for those who oppose the bill. In other words, it doesn't allow them to hide behind a single vote. If Democrats want to oppose securing the vote from the interference of non-citizens, they should have to explain why, at length and in public. Strassel has provided several reasons for opposing this strategy, challenges she calls false promises and huge problems. But her essay leaves out critical details, makes some key factual errors, and is based on unwarranted assumptions. I'll respond to each of her objections one by one. Democrats get two speeches apiece, each of unlimited length, simply to oppose moving on to the bill. This is not true. The Save America Act is coming over from the House in a procedural means known as a message. The vote to move on to a bill when it is packed this way is privileged, meaning the vote is a simple majority vote and no debate is allowed. So it is incorrect to say Democrats get two speeches simply to oppose moving on to the bill. Assuming Senate Republicans vote to get on the bill, then Democrats do get two speeches apiece on the bill itself, under the Senate's two-speech rule. Strassel suggests there is no way to end this torture, but there actually is, physical exhaustion. If the Senate is in session 24 hours a day, a Democrat must be on the floor and speaking at all times. It takes intense physical stamina to do this. To hold the floor, a filibustering senator must stand and speak continuously. He cannot sit, he cannot leave the floor, not even to use the bathroom, and he cannot eat. Are there Democrat senators who can do this? Yes, of course. Can all of them do it for 8 hours and twice, as Strassel suggests? The answer is no. It strains credulity to believe that Senator Bernie Sanders, at the age of 84, has the same physical vigor as Senator Cory Booker, 28 years his junior. This strategy will take time. There is no avoiding that. But senators are not cyborgs. They're humans. They get tired and bored, and they have other demands on their time. Strassel asserts that there is no end, but in fact there is. Time and stamina, both the physical and psychological time, kind, will decide when. Democrats can easily take turns eating, sleeping, and flying home during this marathon. Only one of them needs to be on the floor giving a speech. The GOP, by contrast, will need to maintain almost all its members on the floor at all times. At any moment, Schumer might demand a quorum call, which demands 51 senators. Again, not true. 51 Republicans would not have to sit on the floor, and requiring them all to sit on the floor for hours at a time would merely be filibuster theater. Republicans simply need to respond to live quorum calls. The only person with the power to put in a live quorum call, when senators must come to the floor and register their presence by vote, is GOP Majority Leader John Thune. Democrats can suggest the absence of a quorum, but that does not compel senators to do anything. Only the majority leader has the power to decide when a live quorum call will take place. And when he does, the likelihood is that both Republicans and Democrats will respond and come to the floor. If the Democrats refuse to come to the floor, the sergeant-at-arms will bring them to the floor, per Senate's Rule 6. Schumer could also move to adjourn, which would restart the legislative day, providing Democrats a whole new round of 94 speeches. Any senator can move to adjourn, but simply moving to adjourn does nothing. The motion has to pass. Motions to adjourn are considered at a simple majority and without debate. Assuming a majority of Republicans vote against a Democrat motion to adjourn, it will fail. The legislative day will remain the same, and there will be no new speeches allowed. Indeed, any new question or point sparks another round of speeches. This is also not true. Any new question, an amendment, for example, proposed by the Democrats could be tabled by the Republicans with no debate at all. A tabling motion is a motion that kills the underlying question. It is considered at a simple majority and without debate. If Republicans hang together and table each new question offered by Democrats, there will be no new speeches opened. What is the left's top priority in 2026? Blocking entirely the GOP agenda. A talking filibuster provides Democrats a pain-free, headline-friendly way of taking the Senate and, by extension, the entire GOP Congress offline for a very long period. Democrats would not be blocking the entire Republican agenda. They would be blocking legislation designed to stop illegal aliens from voting in federal elections, an issue that is overwhelmingly popular with the public. Making Democrats do this publicly is the entire point of the exercise. This strategy will take time, but withstanding a filibuster is limited by human factors. Physical exhaustion, political exhaustion, and the nature of 100 people wanting to do 100 other things. Both sides are forced into a negotiation at some point, if only because both of them want to make the pain end. This has a powerful limiting effect on the length of a talking filibuster. Budget reconciliation, a process where senators also have the ability to offer unlimited amendments, usually ends after 8 or so hours. Debate and reconciliation is limited after 20 hours, but offering amendments is not. Senators can continue offering amendments without debate. This is similar to what would happen in a talking filibuster if Republicans put non-debatable motions to table on every Democrat amendment. Every amendment they offered could be tabled in a simple majority vote without debate. Reconciliation's endless amendment process ends for the same factors inherent to a talking filibuster: exhaustion, boredom, distraction, and the desire of senators to do literally anything else. The only way to get to the end game on the SAVE Act, the purpose of this exercise, would be to let Democrats have their amendments. Republicans need to be prepared to table or kill Democrat amendments, even if they are on issues some Republicans agree with, such as overturning President Trump's tariffs. This is called strategic voting, and senators do it all the time. In any reconciliation bill, for example, amendments are offered that are subsequently determined to be fatal or corrosive to the privilege of the bill. That is, if adopted, they would no longer allow a reconciliation bill to pass at 51 votes. In a Republican majority, all senators vote against those amendments, even when they agree with the substance of the amendment, to protect the privilege of the bill. Strategic voting is also how Republicans killed the 2007 amnesty legislation by voting for a Democrat amendment, the substance of which many Republicans disagreed with, to procedurally tie up the Senate floor to their advantage. The same concept is at work here. In an effort to break a filibuster on the Save America Act, hopefully to pass it, Republicans would need to have the discipline to table every Democrat amendment. Republicans could vote to change the rules in numerous ways that restrict the minority's ability to obstruct within a talking filibuster environment. Republicans should not change the Senate rules or use the nuclear option. Strassel suggests that the only way the GOP can use a talking filibuster to pass a clean SAVE Act is to strip Democrats of opposition party rights. However, she does not list what rights she thinks would have to be undone or otherwise modified. There is no need to change any of the Senate's rules or to use the nuclear option to execute a talking filibuster. Republican supporters of the talking filibuster act as if simply changing the mechanics of the filibuster, returning to a talking version, will magically allow them to jam through what they want. It won't. The talking filibuster is not a magical strategy, but it is a strategy. If Democrats are going to block a bill that requires voter ID and blocks illegal aliens from voting, Republicans have two choices. They can ignore the bill and do nothing, or they can hold the Democrats accountable. A talking filibuster is the latter. Talking filibuster supporters are posturing as fighters, those finally willing to slay the zombie filibuster and force Democrats to work for their opposition. That's not how it would work, so they have an obligation to lay out their endgame. Demanding an airtight, guaranteed result before bringing a bill to the floor began roughly 20 years ago and is an aberration of the modern Senate. For 200 years before that, Senate leaders would bring bills to the floor with a degree of uncertainty, and the momentum created by debate, amendment, exhaustion, and negotiation usually, but not always, resulted in passage of the bill. Bringing a bill to the floor when you already know the outcome is not fighting, leading, or even legislating. It is just scheduling. When former Democrat Majority Leader Mike Mansfield brought the Civil Rights Act to the floor in 1964, he didn't have the votes necessary for cloture on either side of party lines. According to the Senate's historian, while his Democrat caucus had 67 members, barely 40 expressed strong support for cloture. He spent 60 days forcing Southern Democrats to filibuster the bill. During that time, the public political process put immense pressure on the opponents, allowed proponents to execute an ongoing strategy and build bipartisan support, forcing both sides into a legislative negotiation, and the result was the filibuster being broken with 71 votes. A talking filibuster forces a process. A specific outcome is never guaranteed. That's the legislative process. But the first step toward getting any kind of outcome at all, besides ignoring the bill entirely, is to try. The extremely good reason that Senate Republicans are keeping the filibuster is because they recognize they will be in the minority again, potentially under a Democratic president, and that the filibuster will be essential to stopping gun control, insane taxes, open borders, a packed Supreme Court, and other progressive priorities. That's wise. Keeping the filibuster is a very good thing, both for the Senate and for the country. What makes the Senate the world's most powerful deliberative body is its tradition of open debate and amendment. The talking filibuster is not a threat to the filibuster. It is the filibuster. In the modern Senate, leaders routinely, almost always, move to end debate before debate even starts. This is not how the Senate was designed and has created a situation that has put enormous pressure on eliminating the filibuster as a means of making the Senate function again. A talking filibuster, using the Senate as it was designed, provides a catharsis that may, in fact, reduce the pressure to nuke the filibuster as the country is able to witness the chamber openly deliberate and negotiate on issues that matter to them. Or, to put it in the words of Senator Robert C. Byrd, when he forced the talking filibuster in 1988. There's no point of having an easy gentleman's filibuster back in the cloakrooms. Let's have it right here on the Senate floor, where the American people can see it. Americans want to see the Senate rise to the level of their expectations, to tangle with hard questions and deliberate with skill and strategy. The talking filibuster has been a tool in the Senate's arsenal for 200 years, and returning to it could unlock the majesty of the institution, which has for too long been dormant and increasingly irrelevant. Now let's move to some thoughts on immigration enforcement. The case for keeping ICE and CPB defunded by Ryan Cooper from the American Prospect. Senate Democrats, somewhat to my surprise, have held the line and refused to support funding the Department of Homeland Security in budget negotiations, and so funding ran out Friday. As my colleague Robert Kuttner reports, Democrats offered Republicans a bargain of funding everything else in the department except ICE and CPB as negotiations continued on immigration enforcement reforms, but they refused. Now, this does not mean ICE and CBP have no money. The agencies got a tremendous one-off dollop as part of the big, beautiful bill, which gave ICE $75 billion, more than seven times its annual budget, and more money than any military in the world except for China's and America's. CBP received tens of billions of dollars in its own right, and both agencies can draw on this money to continue operations during a shutdown. That said, denying baseline annual funding is still a substantial cut for ICE and CBP, and the longer it persists, the deeper the funding reduction will be. Democrats should stick to this line. As long as Trump is in office, these agencies should get no funding through the traditional budget whatsoever. After all, they already have more than they need. As an initial matter, Republicans have already pulled exactly the same move with the IRS. The Inflation Reduction Act had $80 billion in additional funding for the IRS, both to help the agency modernize its severely outdated IT infrastructure and also to conduct resource-intensive audits of rich people. Republicans were absolutely apoplectic about this because a large share of GOP voters and donors and the party's appointees and staff, as well as Republican elected officials themselves, are wealthy tax cheats. So when the GOP won control of the House in 2022, each time the budget process came up, they demanded a pound of IRS flesh from the normal appropriation, thus canceling out a chunk of the extra cash. As my colleague David Dayton explained last month, after several rounds of this, just $10 billion of the funding is left. Lo, there is much rejoicing for the nation's right-wing boat dealership owners who could make their fraudulent deductions in peace. Denying baseline funding effectively claws back the Republican ICE and CBP surge. Each year erodes the reserve of funding and reduces the sums available to continue the nationwide terror campaign. Aside from that precedent, there is a much more important issue at stake here. Many moderate Dems have sounded characteristically squeamish about ICE and CBP funding because they simply assume that there has to be some kind of immigration enforcement agency. What are we going to do? Simply let anyone who shows up roll off the boat at Ellis Island? Have some half-literate border officer change their name from Platsnitsky to Preston? And immediately give them a factory job? Truly, it would be a crime against American history. Setting aside my sarcasm and what immigration law enforcement should look like, nothing like ICE in my view, even before it got magnified, it is simply inarguable that neither ICE or CBP is currently engaged in immigration law enforcement. This is Donald Trump's fascist paramilitary. Just consider how Minneapolis became the target of MAGA occupation. A dim-witted right-wing YouTube guy got fed a bunch of racist lies about Somali Americans by Minnesota Republican officials, and he made a video clumsily repeating the lies, principally by pretending there is something highly suspicious about a daycare refusing to let a pack of strange men come in to see the children. Then that video got artificially boosted on social media algorithms, above all, Elon Musk's Twitter X. That stoked the requisite frenzy to justify violent aggression. Neither ICE nor CBP has jurisdiction over welfare fraud, and they are not equipped to investigate it even if they did. About 91% of Somali Americans are citizens, and most of the rest are legal residents. The welfare nonsense was a pretext to conduct a campaign of terror against a city that is overwhelmingly anti-Trump. Thousands of people have been kidnapped, thousands more have been intimidated, beaten, gassed, or in cases of Alex Preddy and Renee Good, slaughtered like animals. Many people are too terrified of being black-bagged to leave their homes. As I wrote last week, this is causing severe economic damage to local families and businesses. The ICE-CBP mob is Donald Trump's Sturmabteilung. This is Squadrisi, violent thugs beating and murdering leftists and disfavored minorities has always been core to fascism. Italian fascists were the first to develop such paramilitary squadrismo tactics after the First World War, and as historian Robert Paxton wrote, Mussolini made his black shirts available for action against socialists as well as the South Slavs of Fiume and Trieste. I speculated way back in 2016 that local police might serve as Trump's paramilitary, but it turns out federal police are the real thing. If one accepts that argument, then it hardly needs to be argued that ICE and CBP should be defunded until Trump leaves office, after which they should be dismantled immediately. Should the German Social Democrats have voted to fund the Gestapo in 1933 out of fear that the border might get unruly? But there are other arguments as well. If we look at this from the centrist end of the telescope, ICE and CBP should be defunded because they aren't doing their jobs. If immigration enforcement is an important task, it's going undone. Instead, the Trump administration is wasting tens of billions of dollars kidnapping people semi-randomly, many of them legal residents or even U.S. citizens. The appalling nature of this has led thousands of Department of Justice lawyers to quit their jobs, and the resulting flood of lawsuits has totally overwhelmed the ones that remain. Basic functions of federal law enforcement have collapsed in favor of a psychotic effort to deport people like an Irish drywall contractor who has lived here legally for 20 years and is married to an American woman. Even if you accept that some police force must maintain order at the border and perform all of the other tasks given to ICE, like customs inspection, it's plain as day that they already have enough money to do that. If Tom Homan is to be believed that ICE is leaving Minneapolis with future operations geared only toward target enforcement, what does ICE need an extra $75 billion reserve for? The easiest way to draw that money down is to deny baseline funding for the duration of Trump's term. If and when Trump and his fascist goons are thrown out of office, we can iron out a badly needed reform to the immigration system. Until then, it is madness to continue giving money to agencies that are in an undeclared war on the American people. How Did They Think Open Borders Would End? By Ann Coulter, from commonplace.org. Should Democrats and the media tell us their plan to get rid of the 10 million illegal immigrants President Biden let in? Because I'm getting the sense that they don't have one. In fact, I'm pretty sure they don't want anyone deported, ever, for any reason. Notwithstanding the obligatory throat clearing, of course, I support a secure border. Their behavior proves they don't. The Biden administration did everything in its power to get more than 10 million undocumented persons to come here, setting up an app so illegal immigrants could actually schedule their illegal crossings, then rewarding them at the border with free hotel rooms, showers, hot meals, medical checkups, $400 debit cards laundered through the United Nations, and transportation to the American city of their choice. Were these illegal aliens or winners on the dating game? Democratic governors and mayors also encourage illegal immigrants to come with free housing, meals, health care, child care, diapers, healthy snacks, baby formula, driver's licenses, mental health counseling, etc., etc. The de rigueur line, of course, I support secure border, would be like Captain Ahab saying, of course I don't really care about the whale. For their part, the media canonize liberal agitators who swarm ICE agents, throw iced water bottles at them, vandalize their vehicles, and try to provoke officers into an aggressive response that can be endlessly replayed out of context amid commentators' theatrical expressions of horror. While this is inconsistent with liberals' hatred of the police, it is wildly inconsistent with their admiration of President Dwight D. Eisenhower for deploying the military to squelch Democratic governors who thought they could defy federal law. It is also contrary to the New York Times' blindingly clear editorial opinion that when the federal government is deporting non-citizens, Americans have no business blocking them, and elected leaders refusing to aid federal authorities is insupportable. That was about the Clinton administration's campaign to send little Ilhan Gonzalez back to a communist dictatorship. Lucky for the Times, it's been a while since the federal government has made any effort to enforce immigration law. On CNN recently, Oklahoma City's Republican mayor, David Holt, made the amazingly stupid point that we have enforced immigration law in this country for over a century, and ICE has existed for over two decades, and we have never seen this type of chaos in the streets of our cities. I can only assume that Holt was snookered for the entirety of the Biden administration. Also, since he was born, no mayor, we have not been enforcing immigration law in this country for over a century. For quite some time now, no one seems to have noticed that we have immigration laws. The chaos we're seeing surrounding immigration enforcement today is the inevitable consequence when the federal government finally puts an end to decades of open border lawlessness that intransigent opponents want to extend. Americans who simply want their government to follow the law are up against the media, the entire Democratic Party, half of the Republican Party, and half of the other half who say they want to enforce immigration law. At the moment, we are being bombarded with polls, warning Republicans that the American people have changed their minds and decided they want less immigration enforcement. The media's concern for the electoral fortunes of the GOP is touching. Notably, these polls were taken in the immediate aftermath of Alex Pretty being fatally shot by two Border Patrol agents, and before the video of him spitting and screaming at ICE agents emerged in obscure alternative media. In fact, the numbers simply match the decline in President Trump's overall approval ratings. Presidents' approval ratings almost always decline in the first 2 years of their second terms in office. Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and George W. Bush's did. Even Barack Obama's did. But more important, all of the issues Trump ran on, surely the most prominent was his promise of a mass deportation force. Just before his inauguration, even the Times admitted that a clear majority of Americans said they wanted all illegal aliens deported, not, as the media demand, only the worst of the worst. If presidents went by the fleeting emotional reactions of the public, Ronald Reagan would have buckled and reversed his epic tax cuts. The year after Reagan pushed through the largest tax cut in U.S. history, a recession hit, engineered by the Federal Reserve chair to eliminate Jimmy Carter's double-digit inflation rate, and voters decided maybe they weren't so keen on tax cuts after all. Every demographic group wanted Reagan to repeal a scheduled 10% tax cut. Unhappiness with the economy, the Times reported, grew most sharply among Republicans and high-income respondents and appeared to account for the bulk of the Reagan decline. Reagan made a few minor adjustments, closing corporate loopholes, but didn't budge from his overall tax cut scheme. He thus saved the country from one of the greatest crises of existence. We're about to go the way of England and become an also-ran former superpower, unable to create, produce, innovate, or build. The crisis we face today is far worse. Until Trump barged into the presidential race talking about Mexican rapists, the extent of the Republican response to the uncontrolled immigration opposed by most Americans was to reminisce nostalgically about their immigrant roots. And that man was my grandfather, emote about diversity, tell us that illegal immigrants are human beings, and always, always, always add, of course, we have to seal the border, but not with something as preposterous as a wall. That's not who we are. If Democrats don't want to see 10 million illegal immigrants deported, they shouldn't have invited them in. If they don't want federal law enforcement deployed on the streets of progressive cities, they shouldn't have declared them sanctuaries from federal law. If activists don't want an explosive environment that leads to people getting killed, they shouldn't do everything in their power to create that environment by obstructing and assaulting law enforcement officers who are merely doing their jobs. Democrats let in more than 10 million undocumented persons in 4 years. Now they're trying to preserve their gains by making law enforcement impossible. It's not up to foreigners to decide America's immigration policy. It's not up to left-wing activists either. It's up to, what's the thing liberals are worried about losing? Oh yeah, democracy. They thought protesters turning violent in the Capitol for a few hours one day almost killed it. Well, they're staging a mammoth January 6th throughout the blue states that never, ever ends. And those of us who aren't play-acting about democracy, there's no giving up, no matter how much pain and chaos left-wing agitators cause. Well, that's all the time I have for today. You've been listening to the Op-Ed Hour for the Talking Information Center. This is Dan Cobran. Have a great rest of your day.